This question and answer session was presented as a panel discussion on October 20th, 2007, at the 2007 Oktoberfest entitled Reading Minds, Dialogues Between Two Generations. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Proverbial brain-dead portion of the afternoon where our brains are full and it takes some energy and perseverance to carry on, but we're going to do that. Just to let you know where the boundaries are, we're going to go from just a minute or two here. We're going to get started and go till 4 o'clock. 4 o'clock, we're done. It's now 20 minutes to 3. So for the next hour plus, this will be a kind of mini marathon dialogue between all of you and the presenters, tutors and students, and guest presenters. Just having a question and answer dialogue conversation, just a big, wide-open, wide-ranging conversation. And I'm going to try to keep some sense of order. So what's going to happen is, if you have a question or a remark, would you please step to the microphone either on your right or on your left? There's a microphone in the aisle. If we could ask you to step to the microphone to ask your question or to make your remark, so that we can get that recorded on the tape. No, tape would be analog. This is digital. So what is that thing? It's just a digital recorder, right? Okay. That's what we're going to do. They're all there. I'm going to start the session by having us all watch. Actually, you guys might want to get to a place where you can see that. I had an interesting experience while I was doing my prep and research for my bit for this conference. I ran across a website about a film that is being premiered in New York. I think it's probably some small film festival venue in New York next month. The film is called The Unidentified. I have not seen the film. All I've seen is the trailer. But the trailer itself seemed to convey something of the ethos that I, in my opinion, seems to be floating in our world today. And since the film, on two different levels, it seemed interesting as a visual sampler, if you will, of things. One is that it's about, I think, ultimately the kind of things that we've been talking about. The film appears to be about that. And secondly, it's made by young filmmakers. So at two different levels, you could think about what you're going to be watching and the trailer, and the trailer is called, the film is called The Unidentified.
One day all of this will be ours.
Wouldn't it be crazy if we dated?
Probably wouldn't be very different.
Except for the sex and stuff.
We'd get used to it.
God, you look amazing.
I know. Well, that's what happens when actors go costume body.
Sophie, right? I know you.
Oh my God.
Sophie Dewan.
What I do is not really art. It's like the act of living is art, and the choices I make are art.
Blah.
Just stop.
You know I can.
If you're considering risking arrest, you should be up front.
We're both looking for the same thing. We're both looking for...
We're looking for truth.
It has to be broad.
It has to be broad because we're trying to understand the world. So we have to have an objective that's up to that caliber. I'm gonna kiss you tonight.
What would that solve?
Got this thing where someone that I'm attracted to is saying something that I find very interesting. And I get this extreme desire to kiss him.
We should just get married.
And once I know these things, I can change the world. What?
You only think about changing the world because you're an upper middle class white guy who's allowed to think about it.
You know what? If everyone thought like you did, then we'd never get anywhere.
Have fun at the protest, Bill. Tell me if the protesters win.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have an extra special show for you tonight. Let the
world's not such a horrible place. Just get over it. It's just easy to overlook.
Are you happy?
Just a little sampler. Doesn't mean anything. Okay, the way this is going to work is, first of all, I'm going to get this out of the way. And I'm going to invite you right now, if you have a question or a comment, a question you want to ask anyone who made a presentation or made a comment or said something that you were curious about, completely befuddled you, et cetera, et cetera. Please step up. And don't be afraid of the aisles and the mics. Yeah. Go ahead. There's mics right there. Yeah.
I was curious in your talk just now when you were saying that the way you became a Christian was very different than the way your dad became a Christian, and you were highlighting that. I think I began to understand your connection with kind of the breakdown in epistemology and methodology, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about what was different or what finally helped you be able to understand that something was true and something else wasn't true, or if there was something that helped you with that.
Yeah. A big hint for me was there were a couple people at my church, older people. One of them is a man named Harold Goodall. This is at my dad's church that I would visit occasionally when I was kind of home from college. His name was Harold Goodall. I think he was 80 years old. He was a lifelong missionary that was home from the field because he had all sorts of lung trouble, and he was on a respirator. And for some reason, Harold Goodall, he really cared about me a lot. May I get real emotional from that? For no good reason. And I would sit in the back right of church. Like, I'd be way back there, and Harold Goodall would be right there. And he would take his respirator as soon as the sermon was over, and he would go all the way back. I would see him coming for me. He would go all the way back, come all the way around. And it's a long haul with a respirator. Just ask me how I was doing. And he didn't tell me anything about, you know, like, you need to believe such and such, or I hope one day you come along. He just really sincerely cared about who I was and what I was doing. And in my mind, and there was another woman named Jane Colson who was a little bit younger than him, but similar sort of story. She would just come find me and ask me how I was doing. And all I knew was, I want what they have. I don't know how to get there, and I don't know exactly what it is. I presume it's something like a real, authentic Christianity that seemed different from what I usually saw. And all I know is I want that, whatever it is. It's the way that I want. Yeah, that was a tremendously big deal for me. It's just the sort of inner spiritual reality of Christians that really seemed to manifest itself in like the fruit of the Spirit. There's no expiration date. They're there. Is that a decent answer? Yeah.
Okay.
Hi.
Try it again.
Okay. I just want to make a comment that maybe you guys could respond to. I've just noticed that we're talking about the younger generation, and we're hearing from people who are like my age and older, so mid-20s and older. And I just noticed that with a lot of people who are like 5 to 10 years younger than me even, there's a lot of stuff we've been talking about is much more pronounced even. I mean, they have things like, well, MySpace and YouTube and all that stuff, I didn't hear about it until after I graduated from college. So it definitely like has an effect on me, but it hasn't, like, I didn't grow up with that as a part of my reality. So, like, as an example, I was talking to my cousin. She has kids who are in middle school, and she was saying that when they go to slumber parties, her daughter's been really frustrated because she comes home and she's like, all anybody ever wants to do is just play on the computer the whole time. They don't play games, they don't sit around and talk, they don't do any of the things that I know I did when I was in middle school. And I was thinking about that in relation to what Eric was saying about how, like, our generation really clings to a small community of people and those personal relationships. And I'm not sure, and you just get 5 or 10 years younger, I see that maybe even that has been lost. So I don't know, that's just an example, but I see maybe, you don't have to go much younger before you even see a bigger difference in the generation gap.
If I had had more time to talk and study, I was going to go into how I saw personal relationships actually beginning to change with our generation, particularly people younger than us, you know, with MySpace, Facebook, in watching high schoolers and working with youth groups, I actually became really interested in the obsession with video games. And I wasn't that, and so I don't feel like I truly understand everything that's going on there, but in talking to them and watching them, I think that what I feel or what I desire is actually being expressed by them in the video games. And so I've noticed with kids, and I would include myself as a kid, I'm not using that as diminutive, notice with kids that personal connection on MySpace works. You know, there's video games that you put on your headphones and you hold your controller and you're actually talking to the other people over the internet. It's hundreds of people playing this game at the same time, and I think that that actually brings a connection for them. When I think of how I connect with people, you know, we either go out and shoot each other with paintballs, or we go sit down and have coffee and talk about, talk about work or something. I think a lot of these younger kids are, the most exciting thing to them is video games, and so what they are personally connecting over is the world of video games. That's what brings purpose to their life. I guess what I'm saying is I don't know if there's a break between us and the people 10 years younger than us. It just looks different.
Do you think, maybe Casey, you could take this one on, because you were talking about the impact of technology and you looked at this subject matter for a while to get ready for your talk. When you think about those middle schoolers, what kinds of thing in that experience, that scenario that she described, what goes through your mind?
Well, I definitely see a huge gap. I mean, me being 36... I see a huge gap from the personal technology between my generation and, say, Walter's. We didn't grow up with MySpace or Facebook or anything like it. What's so unusual to me is that with each, even 5 years younger, the ability to connect is just done more and more through technology. So, like for my generation, probably yours as well, we'd go sit at a coffee house and sit across from each other and talk. But my friend who's 19, they go to a coffee shop and they text message each other. I mean, it's absolutely, you know, it's profoundly different. So I haven't thought about it in the way you just articulated it, and that's really interesting because I actually can't relate to it at all. So did that answer your question?
Anybody else?
There's no imagination going on. I mean, they're just six girls huddled around the computer, playing with their MySpace and text messaging their friends. So it's just really shocking to me. But as I was listening to technology, was really interesting to me as well. It just sounded like a new drug.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, to go back to Tim's point, to a culture that has no meta-narrative, they're trying to fill up, you know, they're trying to find significance in, well, I don't even know if they're trying to find significance and meaning in, even at that age, at 10. It's just, it's captivating. And to be quite honest, without a parent there sort of shoving a book in their hands or turning the TV off or saying, the laptop needs to go in a public space and it's going to be, you know, we're going to sit and have it in increments. It's not when your friends are over, I want you guys to play. It's captivating. Who wouldn't want to do it? Far more entertaining to go with a laptop than to come up with your own diversions. So I don't know if there's anything really profound going on there. It's just, it speaks to how we want to indulge ourselves as humans. I don't know. Does anybody else want to comment?
My question was also going to be, just as a parent of middle schoolers, the next generation coming up, with everything you've all been talking about, what guidance or what suggestions would you have for parents?
Well, without getting apocalyptic, it was really hard to not get apocalyptic. I'll just say something quick. Something I found really intriguing is how many of the students who spoke talked about the interaction with the older generations and how that made an impact. To every parent of middle schoolers, I would just want to say interact with your kids. Enjoy them, take interest in them, and do it completely aside from their technology. Get them disconnected in a place where you can just interact with them. That will mean something, maybe not in the moment. Maybe they'll want to go jump back on the online to go chat, but at some point, that will mean something. So,
I'm curious. Just 1 second. I'm curious, Walter. How would you respond to that?
What I have going in my mind, I guess, is thinking about how seduced I am by the image. Actually, last night I noticed something. While listening to you with your PowerPoint going on, it was actually somewhat of a distraction because I realized I needed to read those words even at the loss of hearing your own words. And I think you said something along those lines even of how the image is taking over sort of the vernacular or something, the language element. And when I think I started thinking about common experiences, going over someone's house if the television's on, it's incredibly hard to have a conversation. Going to a bar or a restaurant, if there's a television, it distracts me.
Yeah.
I don't even watch television at home. Yeah. I mean, it's there's something about that that's very seductive.
Was it different than taking Jack's paper hard copy and following?
Sort of. I have to read that, too. So I don't know exactly where the line would be.
Okay.
I think I can put that down a little easier, though. That's not as important. I can also read that later. That's
right.
It is. Yeah, I'd say it is different.
Okay.
But in a greater context, even outside of just the lecture, where you had pretty, you know, just a few words, it wasn't too big of a deal. But I was talking to Casey about this while we were discussing what she was going to talk about and technology. And how there was a point, 16, 18, 20, when I realized I need to be very conscious of my relationship with technology, as she was doing technology and what's going on. maybe it was watching A Clockwork Orange, which is a horrible film. Nobody needs to watch it. But this guy has a line, a Stanley Kubrick film, this guy has a line about the only thing that seems really real is when I video it on a screen or something like that. And that just stuck out to me, that there's something true to that. There's something profoundly true in my experience is that there's something much more real when it's viewed on a screen. As Casey said, she wants to hear the soundtrack while she's doing things to her life. And I recognize I need to make a conscious decision to what extent I'm going to interact with technology and media. Perhaps at a level that you guys haven't had to make, I don't know. Thinking about, I set myself one time in the day that I'm allowed to go check it. Otherwise, I'll be on it every 30 minutes. There's something about going back, and it's simple. It's very seductive to just. It's an easy way to waste so much time, and then getting on the internet and researching things, and you know, you spend 3 hours when you meant to check your email.
Yeah.
5 minutes. So I mean, there's, I guess, in response, I don't know where you went, but there you go. I just hopefully that consciousness will occur where she recognizes that she has to make a conscious decision to choose to what extent she's going to use technology as opposed to being used by it, becoming just I guess seduced by it, you know, create her own, I don't know if freedom's the right word, but free herself from it, and that's some sort of personal consciousness maybe that will have to come out. I don't know if that's a good response.
I would be really curious to hear what you guys on the younger side think of. One of the thoughts I have about that question is what I might encourage parents to do is to, this might sound really strange and it might border on apocalyptic, but I think that we need to be eating meals together. I think that something I've noticed as I interact with young people growing up, and I'm actually not talking about the college age students that I work with, but more even adolescents and a little bit younger, is that it's a very unusual experience sociologically anymore for families to have meals together. And it's actually quite unusual for school-age kids to eat meals at all. It's kind of strange to think about, but food preparation and eating together is a really grounding and profoundly ordinary human experience. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I think in that sense, eating together is a really good thing. Also, if you think about what could I do with my kids that's tangible and sense-oriented, so not just unplugging the computer, but then saying, this is how we plant plants in the garden. And so do something that is like touching the earth. I mean, to not be too weird about it, but like something that involves my sense experience. I hear birds when we're outside. I see that trees, the leaves move when the wind blows. I mean, get them outdoors, get them engaged in the real world that's not on the screen. And I guess that's one of my thoughts, is that maybe that would be helpful for kids growing up to find out, oh, there's actually a reality that isn't on the screen. Does that make any sense? How do you guys respond to that?
I just wanted to throw in there, it's so interesting that now we're at this point to start really engaging with people. I mean, there's sort of this realization that we're getting so tied down by our own technology and whatnot. But you mix that in with a postmodern posture, and there's a sense of, no, I need to respect that they don't like authority. I don't want to... I mean, to the extent that I see parents are trying to be politically correct with their kids, and to me, I'm saying, no. You know, engage. Those things that they may be trying to rebel against, having dinner together, is going to mean something later. That's my feeling. So.
And I was just going to respond from my experience, saying that I had dinner around the table 7 nights a week. I mean, we had to be there until maybe I was 16 or something. I was always around the dinner table. That was one thing that was, I guess, set. It was something I never questioned even. But certainly one of my favorite things to do with people is sit around and cook, make food, have a dinner. I was also forced to do a lot of yard work, and I hated it. And now I look forward to this. I've only had a garden for 2 summers now, but I mean, there's certainly something about getting outside of the seduction, perhaps, of of films and CDs, music constantly with these sorts of things. I mean, I, the human experience as well as the inexperience with I suppose gardening or something or doing something with the earth. There's something alive there that none of that. The computer, the CD player, the television is never touched. There's something in there that's still worth not wasting your time on it. So.
And so are you saying that even though you hated that stuff as a kid, it gave you some kind of a grounding that you've been able to come back to and maybe even giving a sense to parents that you're going to get a lot of resistance, but it might still be really valuable to do that. It's kind of what Casey's saying, too. It's like be authorities in a, hopefully in a respectful way, but in a structured way. Is that kind of?
Yeah, that works.
Okay.
Okay, Jessica, do you have a question? Or it's not?
My kind of personal intellectual pursuits for the year are along the lines of math and science as I'm working on my thesis. So I thought it was interesting what you guys had to say about whether or not science had any authority for our generation. And my experience has been that that since there's kind of so many different like sects of a scientific community and kind of regularly they each come out with like their new discoveries or whatever, that they kind of like undermine their own authority. So that you really don't think you're just like, yeah, that's cool, but like nobody really believes what you guys are saying. But like in another way, it seems like there's still a lot of hope, I guess. Like it seems like some of like the modernist like belief in science is still carried over in some way that like maybe there is kind of a process of like testing what we know to be true or kind of it's almost like, and I think this has to do with kind of like the virtual realities, is that like we kind of feel like we've conquered or we have a pretty good grasp on like the visible world, and so we have to like explore like the invisible world of like quantum mechanics to find like deeper meaning to reality. And some people that I've talked to in the last year actually, if science and like religious, like different religions don't actually have like real authority, but people are still like really longing for like meaning and a sense of like what am I supposed to be doing, so they kind of like create those things or like put their own meaning into like science or religion so that they kind of like construct their own like authority for themselves. I don't know if this really makes sense. But we had a group together last year and watched What the Bleep Do We Know? And it was actually, I mean, it was kind of a really crazy movie, but it was worth the time at least to just try to like, what's going on here? Like, what are they doing? But it was a really interesting connection between finding like spiritual significance out of science, of like, how are we all like on Earth, and like how are we supposed to like interact with each other when we're like coming from, you know, everybody kind of has their own like take on reality or whatever. So it was just kind of an interesting development for like science to almost kind of become a new religion. And I don't know if like any of you guys would have anything to say about whether you see that actually having authority or if you thought about that.
So is your question whether science still has authority or still has a kind of authority that other disciplines don't have in our culture?
Maybe I don't really have a question formulated at this point. I'm just like kind of putting that out there that I've kind of experienced that it seems like some people are still really looking for some sort of authority, even if they kind of are trying to make it themselves. Like, it's not, like, objective authority. It's like, I want authority, but this is how I'm going to create it. And they kind of do that through, like, trying to find, like there's still stuff to discover. We can still discover stuff through quantum mechanics. That there's still stuff beyond what we know. There's still some sort of like mystery, and like I even think that I don't know, a lot of friends that I'm interacting with, I don't think that a sense of meta narrative is gone completely, that there still is like something kind of underlying what we experience, but it's what they want it to be. It's not like God's story, it's like quantum mechanics story or whatever. So I don't know, maybe there's no question there, but if you guys like have any thoughts about that.
If I'm not sure I'm hearing exactly what you're after either, but is part of it the fact that, for example, I was making a big case for the fact that if the future, a vision of the future is closing down for a set of reasons, that knowledge shrinks. The purpose of knowledge, the usefulness of knowledge, the compelling nature of knowing something begins to die. Because why would you want to know something if there is no future? There's no future to the knowing. So are you suggesting that science maybe is still this vestige, this remnant within our culture, where those who are, at least those who are in it, still believe that that knowledge is useful and possibly even has a future?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe that's kind of what I'm feeling. It seemed like, as crazy as I thought what the belief did we know was to me, like that was just so off the wall. It seemed like the people who were in it were feeling really hopeful and really positive. Like,
okay. Any comments up here? Thoughts? Okay.
The first part of what you said, that science seems to be kind of like one day this, one day this. I think Eric brought it up. And I had the exact same thought. I thought 5 years ago it was not okay to put your baby on its back because that was dangerous. Now, today, you should put your baby on your back when she sleeps. It's okay. And 5 years later, it'll be the opposite, you know. And I hear that and I'm like, yeah, science is a method of inquiry. It's obviously produced incredible results with regards to healing, removing pain, medical care. Speaking for myself, I don't put much hope in science for its ability to answer like a big question. The thing that always intrigues me, the thing that makes me think, oh, science maybe offers some kind of like broader answer, is at the edges of science where it gets to the point where it starts getting very mysterious and sort of these are the things that we can't explain. Then I always get sort of intrigued. Oh, maybe you're getting up against the question, or you know, you're approaching something. But I don't have a whole lot of hope in science giving us tools or some sort of way to approach the bigger question. But mine may be real unique in that way.
I have seen What the Bleep Do We Know, and I just building on that. And what could be really more attractive than something like a religion that you can tack on with science that may or may not at the time be, who knows if we really call it an authority. But through that, it gives us, in that film, it gives us this profound way of explaining me without actually having to deal with me. That film was very interesting. The kind of spiritual experience that they were putting forward is like, would have seemed to me like the answer to every postmodern person's sort of quest. I mean, it's, you can
practically be an atheist and all of a sudden be spiritual.
Can you guys say a little bit more about the movie? I haven't seen it.
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it. Can you give us a
go for it, Jess?
What was the title of the movie again? What was it? Oh, what the, do we know?
Yeah.
Okay.
But no, it's actually...
What the... It's basically this quest to find spirituality through quantum mechanics. And it's looking at alternate states of existence.
I don't remember a lot about the movie. I just remember kind of like the impact that it had.
Wes, it's Mind Walk 10 years later.
It is. It's Mind Walk 10, absolutely. Yeah. If you saw Mind Walk.
Okay, right over here.
Sorry.
seen things I know in my life, my family. My sister and I are 3 years apart, and we talked about the death of the grand story, or the revolution is dead. I graduated from college in 1964. My sister graduated in 1967. Night and day between the two of us. She is as far left or further left than I am further right. and the conservative and the other side of it. The influence of my generation is soon going to be gone if there is an influence of the grand story of that group. And change and technology and everything is changing so fast, just as it was between myself and my sister. Even today, with the technology changes in families between siblings 4 or 5 years apart, their lifestyle is completely different. I guess one of my concerns is, are we going to see the pendulum start to swing back the other way? How far are we going to go that way? Are we going to hit a global Marxist society before anything starts to change and then a huge revolution taking place? Or do you think things will level themselves out?
I don't know. But I want to cite something that was very interesting to me when I was in grad school. When I first moved to Eugene in 1977, I think it was probably 1978, I entered grad school, and I read a book that was required for one of my classes called The Human Prospect by Robert Heilbronner. So the date on the book was about 1975 when it was published. What was intriguing was it was an unfolding, unpacking of a critical, analytical view of what was really going on in the world, kind of the stuff that we've been talking about. And the furthest from being a believer or a theist or Christian or anything like that. And it was a chilling prospect. And this was in 1975. Heilbronner suggested that the only thing that he saw that would stop this accelerating breaking up of foundations would be what he saw as a rising up of a totalitarian regime that was capable of potentially enveloping the world, and so military totalitarian power, and that it would be religious.
And
that it would be religious. It would have a spiritual backbone to it.
He saw that as the only way that the crumbling would stop.
The only way, what he was just suggesting, that this, the only thing, are we facing the possibility that the only prospect of sort of stopping the entropy that we seem to be seeing, the fragmenting and the dissolution of foundations, he saw that only being glued back together again by a totalitarian political and religious spiritual structure. And that was in the mid-70s. So I don't know. Yes, over here.
I might be looking for too simple of an answer, but I deal with college students too, and I hear them say a lot of things, same things I've heard you all say today in terms of their world and their worldview. And I guess, but they also have no background of God in their life. They've never been raised with God, and they don't have any sense of hope, or there's nothing spiritual in their life, and they don't even consider that. And it's part of, in their view, and I wondered if there's a... I would love to be able to say something or give them a book, recommend a book. I should have a little stack of books I can hand to them that might open their mind up to consider God or hope or... I don't know, do you have any favorite books that you would recommend?
Yeah, I think so. before I offer those up, I want to kind of echo what Tim said earlier, and that epistemology was the thing that drove you insane. And that's what drove me insane. I mean, I grew up as a Christian, and so I've had the Christian background, and I'm still part of my culture, and so welcome to my schizophrenia. I mean, I have to deal with the fact that I believe these things, but what reason do I have to believe them? You brought up the example of the Muslim. If I was born in Cairo, I'd be a Muslim. That literal problem has driven me nuts for 6 years. Like, I'm a Christian because I was born to a Christian family and a Christian culture, and I've never not been a Christian. So what does that say about my ideas? So I would recommend, when I was in high school, I became quasi-agnostic and started reading a bunch of books on epistemology, trying to answer the questions, trying to find somebody that would prove Christianity for me. And I read, there's a two-part series of, like, proving, Josh McDowell, Evidence That Demands a Verdict. I was reading books like that that were trying to prove Christianity, and they ran off me like water off a duck's back. Like, it did not connect. I'm not exactly sure why, but arguments for Christianity, I felt like there must be a spin, or there's got to be a catch here. There's reasons why people believe Islam. So I would recommend books that aren't necessarily arguing facts.
I agree with what you're saying is true, because anytime I try to just tiptoe around the subject, I just get a blank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I've discovered that what has worked for me, and I hate to use that term because, I mean, what's that mean? It's worked for me. But the things I've connected with or that have helped me have been people writing down their personal journeys through life, looking for truth, and particularly in Christianity. And so the two books that I mentioned, Blue Like Jazz by Donald Miller and Irresistible Revolution by Shane Claiborne, there's plenty in those books that I disagree with, but seeing people that were honest about the questions, that were trying to rephrase Christianity in terms of their experience and this reality really helped me out. And then if, you know, anything the Gutenberg tutors, right, would... and I'm not getting paid for that. But, I mean, these guys helped me out a ton as well, and I think because of the same kind of things, that there was a dialogue about the journey, there was stories about the personal, and there was an opportunity to ask questions and be honest about those questions rather than getting preached at or trying to have something proved to me.
I'll go back. When Nancy and Eric were talking on stage, and Nancy said to Eric, after hearing you say this, I expect you probably feel really lonely. It probably feels like you're really off by yourself. I told Nancy at lunch that had I had that conversation with Nancy, the fact that she could empathize that deeply with me, like the way that she did with Eric, the fact that she could empathize that deeply, she would then, to me, have license to say almost anything she wanted to. And so I think more than giving a book, it's really profoundly caring. And not, I don't mean caring in a simple way, but really wanting to know why they are the way they are, not for any reason other than you care. I almost felt like when I was growing up, I sort of had developed two epistemologies. One was my dad's, and one was an epistemology of just empathy. I had to try to walk in someone's shoes to try to understand anything about what they believe, profoundly and deeply walk in their shoes. And I didn't do a great job of it. But sort of empathy and epistemology were very closely tied, if not almost the same thing for me. And they still kind of stay, they remain that way.
I thought of one more book. A New Kind of Christian by Brian McLaren. It's less about the journey and more about ideas, but it was extremely helpful for me as well. And I've heard his other stuff, Brian McLaren, his other stuff is very good as well. That's the only book I've read.
In my interaction with students at Gutenberg, one of the things that I've learned is what they've been saying about their sense of mistrust, you have to take that seriously. They do not trust anybody easily. And our experience at Gutenberg is that it takes 2 years of interacting with students on a daily basis before they can decide whether they trust us or not. So it's a long-term process to develop that kind of relationship. But once you have that kind of relationship, then you can talk about things, and they'll listen.
I just have one book. It depends kind of on the student or the person and where they are, I suppose, even in terms of their intellectual curiosity, how much of it is actually a compelling philosophical issue, even the plausibility of God. But at that level, and if they have, particularly if they have some sort of interest in social-cultural issues or sociology in particular, I found a little book by Peter Berger called Rumor of Angels. It's just a little book, to be very intriguing, because he suggests in that book that there are built into reality, into human experience and into external reality, what he calls signals of transcendence, that there are certain fundamental human experiences that point. So depending on, you know, where, who the student was, what their interest was, that might be an interesting approach. I think we go back over here.
I'll add a couple of things to that. Just, in a more traditional spiritual vein, Thomas Merton and Henry Nouwen, I think, are pretty good apologists who are writing apologetics. Thomas Merton's autobiography, The Seven Story Mountain. Thomas Merton. But also, Tim quoted from Andy Dillard. I think if someone has a sort of interest in nature and that sort of thing, or Wendell Berry, both sort of nature writers in a kind of Christian vein. Close. And Anne Lamott has spoken to a lot, I think, non-Christian secular type people.
Donald Miller, actually, Andy Dillard, that was one of the first books that really intrigued him. I didn't know if you know that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh, and Frederick Buechner. I guess I think of those people because they have a sort of self-critique or critique of Christianity and the church themselves. So it's not this... Josh McDowell is, it seems more like the church can do no wrong. There's nothing wrong with the church or the Christianity. They have a bit more circumspection about it or something that seems to be more genuine and real to me. I'm sort of caught between the two generations. But my question is about the theorists of post-modernity, Foucault and Derrida mentioned, and Lyotard. I guess I wonder, can we learn anything from them? I guess I've got my impression that they're basically relativists, and they're sort of the enemy. But I guess I wonder if they haven't been trying to continue this revolution that's supposedly dead, and if their work isn't more subversive, and maybe because they have a critique of modernity that or modernism that maybe as Christians we also have a problem with modernism, and maybe we could find some more common cause with them, and maybe extend their critique or something like that.
I'll speak just very quick, make one comment. It does strike me, well, actually, Tim, you and I were talking yesterday about, and you made some comments about how you thought that there was a critical, that they were presenting a kind of critical apparatus, if you will, and posture that, while on the one hand might be seen as destructive in its deconstructive tone, on the other hand, still was incredibly analytical. It opened up. Would you say something about that for a second?
Yeah, it seems like, from what I've read in the authors that you quoted, Brent, they seem largely to be critiquing something that does exist that has fallen really short, and that's maybe even failing, modernism. And in that respect, I really like them a lot. But it seems like they're almost exclusively critiquing something that is, with not a whole lot of like hope for, here's a great alternative. I really like Alistair MacIntyre. I think he's a great alternative because he offers something very positive. Maybe I can articulate it in this way. I was reading a book called Deconstruction in a Nutshell, which is sort of a synopsis of Jacques Derrida's writing. And Jacques Derrida, Deconstruction, you heard Wes talk a little bit about it. The book is going on and on, and then it gets to a part where it talks about Rosa Parks sitting, refusing to move to the back of the bus, and it lauds Rosa Parks for that decision. And at that point, I came really close to closing the book and putting it away, because they take for granted that Rosa Parks' action was a just action, but there is no way that they could really affirm that, even though I think they're right to affirm it and say, yeah, she should not have moved from the back of the bus, but there's no means by which to affirm that, yes, that was a just thing to do. You know what I'm saying? So I thought that was disingenuous, and in as much as they take certain things just kind of for granted, I get a little bit suspicious.
Jack, were you going to say something?
Well, a number of years ago, I think we had two or three October fusses. Is that the plural?
Fusai.
devoted to disenculturating Christianity. And although most of us did not come to our perspective on Christianity through postmodernism, I couldn't even spell postmodernism when I was developing some of my ideas, there's a lot of similarity between the way they are looking at the power of culture, the power of the rationality of a community, and how that shapes you, and that is exactly in line with what our institution is all about, wanting to disenculturate Christianity by allowing Christians to see how much the Christian cultures that they have built is what creates the Christian truth for them, rather than something that transcends all those cultures. Where I would differ, I think, if I understand them, is I believe that there is a truth that breaks through all that. I mean, because I believe in the meta-narrative. And the odd thing is, it seems to me that Foucault does too. It's just a different one. It's a different meta-narrative. So there's a lot of power. Yeah, there's a lot of tools. There's a lot of ideas. There's a lot of approaches that they bring to their critique of modernity that I think is very helpful and should instruct us a lot.
Over here. We forgot to.
And I really, I think this was great. And I think I have comments, and hopefully you can comment on my comment. I don't know if it's a clear question. I grew up or started in a third world country and grew up overseas and then found myself in my teen years back in the United States. And so I could really relate to some of what Eric was saying about this, even though we were really closely linked to the military life, we weren't in the military, but we had this awareness of America, and I was not an American until I was 7. And so the idea of who you are as America, an American was something that I formed a little bit later in my childhood than some kids do, I think, who grow up just, you know, red, white, and blue through and through. But it's been something that I've been thinking about because I find myself now in this new landscape for me as a 36-year-old homeschooling mother, thinking about my 7-year-old, my 1-year-old, well, she's not even 1 year old, but how to relate to her, the two girls, but also how to fit in and sort of hold back the floodgates of technology where they should be held back, and be sort of a responsible steward of this tons of information. And in some ways, I was kind of laughing as I was listening to the technology discussion and the image discussion, because my husband and I as artists and have gotten more and more interested in some aspects because it is easier. Instead of me doing photography in a dark room, I can do it on my computer. And I probably am not going to get sick from all the drugs, or not the drugs, but the chemicals that you would deal with if you were in the dark room. And so that's like an added bonus. And yet, there is something sort of funny about being able to just click a button and do the exposure, whereas before I would have to sit there and methodically go through and do test strip after test strip to get the right exposure. And I had to do the work to think, okay, this is what the f-stop is, where's the aperture, what's the gray card say, you know, all these things to get to the correct exposure. And we don't have to do that anymore in the same way. And I guess, you know, my question, if I had a question maybe, would be, how do we balance, and this is more about the homeschooling mom aspect, how do we balance technology and worldview aspects? Because these little kids are going to be 20-year-olds and the, you know, and I feel this huge responsibility as a parent. And
that was a good question. Thanks. Anybody? I think the beginning of it is just the kind of awareness that you are exhibiting. I mean, I think that I don't know if this gets it or not, but there's something about what one of the things that the postmodernist, post-structuralist theorists have debunked is the notion of something they call presence. Has anybody up there ever studied what they mean by the term presence? I could be wrong in this, so I'm going to give you my spin on it. It seems to me that what they're getting at is that this notion of presence is related to the notion of truth, and that the truth has an authenticity that's grounded ontologically in us. That is, we it's something we can actually, in some sense, touch, get in touch with. So the notion of presence, if you and I sit down and have coffee, and look in each other's eyes and talk, you know, and I'm transparent with you about something I'm hurting about, there's a kind of presence that emerges between us that's real. That happens between a parent and a child, or it doesn't. And it somehow, it seems to me that in the physical nature of our bodies and the world, there's a kind of authenticity, a kind of presence attached to that physicality, to that. It's psychological, but it's also almost body and material. So it's this connection between the body, the soul, the spirit, the immaterial, and the material that's built into us and that we somehow can experience when we're really being human the way God intended us to be human. And what the postmodernists, the more radical ones, are suggesting is that that's just a myth. That's just a cultural construct. It's not real. There's a book by a man that I have just absolutely been enthralled with recently, named an author by the name of George Steiner, who wrote a book called Real Presence. And it's not only is he a beauty to read, although it takes a little while to get into his vocabulary and his rhythm as a writer, but it's amazing. I've said this to many people recently. You read him and you think, how did he come up with that? I mean, how did he say that? How did he put those words together in that syntax? Because it's just amazing what he does. But even in the very writing, in the way he's done it and what he's described, it's as if there's a presence. He also suggests that, and I don't remember who he was referencing, but that music, of all the arts, music has a resonance that's somehow connected to this notion of presence in us, and that's why music is so powerful to us, why it has this great power in our lives. So it just seems to me that being aware that you can lose presence by certain kinds of habits and a certain kind of exposure to things that move away from, if you will, the analog to the digital. And the analog is a groove going through vinyl. It's real physical, to the digital, where it's just these binaries. Little dot. I mean, you know, I'm being metaphoric here, you know, but something along those lines, and being a parent who's at least aware of that kind of stuff, and then being in connection with other parents who have this conversation going on.
Well, and that would be when you're talking about micro communities. I was kind of just sitting there going, Tech and I are really into blogging, and we like to blog because it is not only just about possibly sharing and being community with people specifically, but also it's a practice of writing, and it is an actual art form for us. There is some concerns that we have about transparency, who's reading us, all these things that we're asking these questions, but it's also been this great opportunity, and I thought it was kind of funny because I was just thinking, because I got a new iPod, that I was going to download from the Gutenberg website some new MP3s, you know, files so I can listen to that. And I thought, that's a good thing. Technology is not completely evil, but again, it's pulling back those floodgates. And then also blogging, I was, you know, in a week we're starting a women's blogging, I'm embarrassed to say it, blogging Bible study, and some of the participants are ex-Gutenberg students. And it's just one of those things where I thought, I never would have thought I would have done this. But it's a really good thing.
Yeah.
I'm not blogging all blogging.
I probably should have been more obvious in my presentation. Technology is not evil. I don't. But my whole goal was to kind of express how it manages to influence our lives in this way. It's completely. It's not obvious to us.
It's huge.
And it's absolutely huge. And so I don't think you shouldn't feel bad about blogging and whatnot. But it is, I think it just has to be really consciously balanced with the human element, like with your kids or with your spouse or whatever, with your trade. I think there's a sense where keeping in touch, being human in everything that you're doing. So maybe even once in a while, I know you're right, I grew up, my mom's a photographer. I grew up in the dark room, so we always were around those chemicals. But even it would be nice, even as an artist like yourself, to go back and just once in a while remember what it was like to be in the dark room. There's just this sense of keeping touch. It's like the farmer who's going to actually walk outside and do something with his hands as opposed to always with his tools. I think that's just something to consider.
Okay, Deb?
Thanks. I think I've been so struck and really appreciate the younger you are, the more, I think, in this context of the clarity with which I think this issue of distrust and sort of a lack of meaning and a hunger for something that's real, and a sense of aimlessness or hopelessness about that. I mean, that to me has been very profound and powerful here in the U.S. And my question or comment has changed radically in the last even 5 minutes as other people have come up before me. But I think one thing that I saw in the comments was not a huge split, but this whole issue of, on the one hand, talking about academic knowledge, we're talking about knowledge and doctrine, and on the other, I felt like I was really hearing a sense of belonging, a sense of the experience, again, the real, the relational. And it makes me, I was particularly struck by Tim's comment when, I think Nancy, you asked him to say a little bit more about what helped him to ultimately turn around in his theological quest. And he's at Lavery thinking his brain's out. And what does he remember but two people from his father's generation who just came up to him and asked how he was? And I guess as I was just hearing these things, I thought to me that, or that the simplicity of that response was profound, or the power of it, is that his epistemology ultimately became real human love and the embodiment of Christ. And I guess I was struck by the sense of, we can talk about, the epistemology has been critical for me. You know, I've talked about that. But as we talk about knowledge, the sense of, we can so easily talk about knowledge in a way that's just about our brains. And I think there's no mistake in Jesus being incarnate. In that as we look for meaning, as we look for reality, it has to be somehow in the presentness of being together and of love. And I think as I thought about this more, as we can go to technology as some sort of drug and escape, and where we can be in virtual relationship, and I agree, I think there's a lot of value to parts of that, extremely. And yet, it also means that we can just escape. We never have to deal with the hard things about each other. And I think that's what I said. When I really know that there's love, it's that I've been with people enough that they know my junk, and I know theirs. And that's when there's the meaning and the reality. So it's like Jesus actually being with us, and that what does it mean to have to stay with each other and not just slip in and out of each other's lives? That's the hard part. I think it's the part we're not very good at. But I think coming back to Tim's comment, it's the part that is probably the most powerful in our having any sense of certainty or hope that there is anything that's real.
Thanks, Deb.
You're welcome to comment.
I might make a comment about that. I was also struck with, in after Eric and I did our session, I was thinking about, Eric, what you said about the lyrics of the song that we watched and how the visual was really more the message, which I thought was interesting in and of itself, that the fact that the song was about a breakup of a relationship had kind of passed me by. And as I thought about that, I thought about how profound it is what Deb is saying about and what you guys are all saying about the profound nature of human connection and love and how huge that is, that we are actually... I have two thoughts. One is that as this generation finds meaning only, I mean, I'm being exaggerating maybe, but only in relationships with one another, those relationships are going to end up being really difficult, and they're going to end up breaking apart, and they're going to end up not ultimately providing the meaning that we need and want as humans. And yet, it's so profound to me that having a true sense of connectedness, it's like in understanding who God really is and that Jesus, that God showed up in the form of Jesus, that we are really not alone, as the video portrayed. And I think that's really huge, because even as we connect with one another and hurt each other and fail each other and expose our junk to one another, finding mercy together is hugely meaningful. And that was just striking to me as I thought more about what we were talking about, and a couple people made a comment to me about that that connection. So I just wanted to kind of add that.
Well, I'm not a scientist, but I play one at home. I just wanted to comment on authority or lack of authority. I think our ultimate authority for us is God. But in our society, you know, we've done our best to remove God from the schools and from the media, and that's where all the children, that's where they get their information from, is when they go to school and see movies and on TV. So then the next authority for the United States would be the president. You know. But then we get other authority figures attacking, you know, the president. For instance, just a couple of days ago, and a senator say that the president purposely lied about the war in Iraq just so he could watch these soldiers die, you know, which is totally outrageous, and I'm sure, you know, it's fairly transparent. So, you know, you've got a senator saying that, it's obvious that he's got his own agenda, so you've got these authority figures attacking each other, and that sort of negates, you know, they lose their authority then. So then the next authority figure would be the parents. But then you have the schools again going, well, here, we'll give you condoms to help you so you can have sex, but your parents are not allowed to know this. So they're sort of taking away the authority from the parents. And then on the scientific front, you know, you get they have consensus in scientists saying stuff, but it's usually not, there's not a scientific basis for it. It's just if a bunch of scientists get together, okay, how many people here believe man has caused global warming? So you get 99 people, scientists say, oh yeah, that sounds good. Then you have one guy, well, I have data that shows that it's long-term solar cycles. And, well, we've got 99 other scientists that feel that it's, you know, it's man. Besides, we know that you look at internet pornography, so your data is invalid. Yeah. And so it's no wonder that there's no authority figures, that there's like a concerted effort to destroy all the authority figures.
Comment? Anybody?
Do I need to say anything?
Okay, thanks for the comment. Yes.
I was only here for the morning session.
Walter?
Walter. Walter, you were talking about authority, three sources of authority. I see you're addressing authority in terms of power. Then what seemed to get interesting to me that in your exchange, you talked to the two of you, David, you were talking about sources of authority, and then you would switch to sources of truth, almost as if they were interchanged. And it seems to me a source of truth would be a epistemological concept. A source of authority is a territorial one. So when I think of my generation, or for myself, Martin Luther King's final speech at Atlanta was a source of great authority for me. And in part because it may or may not have been true, or may have been true, but also because it invited me. It invited engagement. It connected, demanded some kind of ethical response on my behalf. And it seems that sources of authority may or may not be true. So I guess my question, if you look at this question, this relationship between authority and truth, and see that maybe in this postmodern age there's a loosening, I guess my question for the three young people here is, what texts and films, poems, songs, what kind of texts have this a rhetorical significance for you, and what is that link, what is or is not that link to truth? And maybe you can, and I'm asking not only as individuals, but also as representatives of your generation. Is there, what is this relation between truth and authority, and how is it actually played out in terms of what you're drawn to? Does that make some sense?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. It's a good question and distinction as well. I guess what comes immediately to mind is I think what you brought up first is the idea of being born into a specific situation. And I've always associated this with some sort of postmodern mindset, but being born into a Christian household. The only reason that is truth, the only reason that it stands as an authority that correlates with truth is because of the sort of haphazard I happen to end up in this home, and therefore I will be a Christian. I've struggled with this a lot. I mean, because of this very problem, there is no... Yeah, I still don't know a definitive way to cut between or to distinguish the two, perhaps. If something is truth, it is going to be authoritative. And if I suppose on the other side of that, though, maybe this is where it gets fuzzy, is if something's an authority, it's not necessarily true. And that's where, I mean, that's the whole issue with this sort of the... I mean, the last thing we sort of... The last thing David and I ended on were... Things stand out because there's some sort of passionate conviction, and therefore that becomes an authority and becomes a sort of relativistic truth. There's a certain sort of relativism behind all of that.
That way.
Okay, we're actually at the end of our time by 3 minutes here, so I'm going to bring this officially to a close. First of all, thank you all very much. Tim, thanks for coming.